Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, the UK's favourite vicar, Kate Bottley, shares life lessons and wisdom she's garnered from wonderful people she's met throughout her life. Her latest book, Have a Little Faith, is for everyone. Whether you have faith or not, Bottley will equip you with the tools to ride the bumpy waves of life. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this episode is a warm cup of tea for the heart and soul.
Should we walk out?
I think we should.
Do you want to pass those around? I'm not sure how far these will get, but I'll go and buy some more if we need to. Can't do it without sweets, can you?
You can't.
It's like a, you know, four fruit pastel sermon. You know you're onto a big one when it's that.
Hi, everyone. How are you doing?
Hello, Liz.
You're all right? That was very muted. Everyone all right? It's because you're all eating sweets, isn't it?
That's a secondary school teacher trick, that. I used to be a secondary school RE teacher on a Friday afternoon with year nine boys, 30 of them in a classroom. And I used to take lollies and sherbet dip dabs in because they couldn't then talk because they were so busy eating the sherbet dip dabs. So that's a little trick.
Sherbet dip dabs, things of
good,
wonder.
Aren't they?
They are absolutely fantastic.
I haven't dip-dabbed in ages.
Well, listen, everybody enjoy your sweets. For the next hour, we are going to, be entertained and thought-provoked by the Reverend Kate Bottley. I'm Peg Alexander, local journalist, presenter. You'll often see me on TV, hear me on the radio, at events like this, on podcasts. And I'm dead chuffed that I'm going to be in conversation with you. I am dead chuffed.
I'm dead chuffed too.
Good. That always makes it a lot easier when we're both...
It always makes it a lot easier when someone knows what dead chuffed means, to be honest with you. Just a minute, we're having our photo taken.
Okay.
Just to say, look natural.
Sit up.
The trick is with that, by the way, yeah, is to put your tongue in the roof of your mouth because it brings your chins up. So that's the trick. You're all doing it now, aren't you? Like saying the words pelvic floor in a room full of women, and we all start.
So we're going to be chatting about your new book, Have a Little Faith.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to be chatting. I think we're going to be lots of chat about the nature of faith and religion and spirituality and where it sits in our society at the moment. Mm-hmm. We'll obviously get onto some showbiz stories, I'm sure.
Oh, and I've got so much gossip.
Yes, exactly. Bit of goss and all that kind of thing. We'll just see where it gets us, and we'll obviously have good time for questions and some wider chat. So I'm going to start off though on the faith thing, if that's all right.
Sure.
Let's get right into God. And start there.
She'll be thrilled.
Yeah. Well, we can come on to pronouns,
okay,
in a minute. Yep, we'll leave that one for just a bit. But there's a number of lines that for me, I was brought up a Catholic. I mean, I'm the youngest of nine, so that tells you. I was brought up a Catholic, and at this point, I feel I need to confess to you that I am an atheist.
Absolutely,
okay?
Absolved of all.
Thank you, because I do feel like I need to confess at this point. But, you know, there's a number of things and lines you've written in your book that I'm going to kind of pull out for us to talk about. And
okay,
one of them I think is really interesting. It's very early on, you talk about your role as a vicar, and you describe yourself as a curator of conversations about faith,
yeah,
not as an instructor of faith.
Yeah, so what happens for me is people quite often stop me in the street and they'll go, oh, I'm not, the first thing they go, oh, I'm not religious. And like it's the worst thing they could be, right? Like they're going, I'm not a serial killer. I've never robbed a bank. You know, like they're like telling me something that would be awful if they were. So they do that thing where they go, I'm not religious. Or they feel the need to apologize. They go, I'm really sorry, I'm an atheist. And I'm like, do you know what? I don't take it personally. It's absolutely fine. It's that thing of, and then what happens is in the course of the conversation when they've told me they're not religious, which I always wonder, if they go up to a vicar and say I'm not religious, do they go up to like a builder and go, I can't do plastering, I'm not an electrician, like, do you know what I mean? What are you apologising for? I don't get paid anymore if you're religious. That my kind of income is set, really.
Or paid,
yeah, do you know what I mean?
In terms of God's grace.
It's not going to get me in any sooner. No. I'm not going to get an extra shiny seat. It doesn't work like that. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is after they've confessed that they're not religious or whatever, they then go on to tell me something that sounds quite religious. So they do this. I'm not religious, but I do like lighting a candle if I go into a church. Or, but I do like singing hymns. Or, but sometimes I think there might be something bigger in the universe. They say things like that. And I just think, firstly, I always want to lean in and go, you know, that sounds quite religious, right? Sorry to let you know that. And so then what happens is they proceed to tell me about the God that they don't believe in, which, guess what, isn't the God I believe in either. You know, and that's what happens is I think what we've done is if you ask a six-year-old and a 96-year-old to draw a picture of God, who brought Rustly sweets? Who's handing them round? If you ask a six-year-old and a 96-year-old to draw a picture of God, they would draw the same thing. Because our theology, our understanding of the thing that's bigger than us, I call it God, you might call it something different, it never grows beyond that age, right? So we never think about it because we're a bit embarrassed and we're a bit awkward and we think we might get it wrong and we haven't got the language. And so we just, our theology, our understanding of something bigger than us, our spirituality, becomes stunted at a very, very young age. And then adding to that perhaps unhelpful theology that other people have given you, unhelpful imagery that people have given you, Granny's died, where's Granny? Oh, she's a star in the sky. That's fine. But what about when you find out that that's not what stars actually are? You know, and then you think as a grown-up, well, I thought stars were my granny, but now that all that sort of, because we're trying to make things better and we're trying to have the answers, actually, sometimes it's just better to go,
And you admit that there's a lot of stuff that you say you don't know. You're very honest in the book, aren't you?
Well, the only logical position, I'm sorry, I mean, I'm speaking as a theist and as an atheist, actually, who knows? Because actually the only logical position is agnosticism, because it's by nature, it's a thing that cannot be proved. You know, I had an email from a gentleman a little while ago that said, when were you so sure that God existed? And I wrote back and put, hopefully any day now. You know, that's the whole point. It's called faith. It's not called sure. And you add into that as well the way that religion specifically is being used to control and manipulate and advance all sorts of things that I won't sign up to. You know, it's almost like you've got a couple of choices. You can either throw the whole thing out and go, this is irredeemable because of all the stuff we've laid on top of faith and belief, then we're throwing it out. Or you can go, right, where is this helpful? Where is this spiritual muscle? Because I believe everybody's a spiritual being, whether you acknowledge that or not. I think that muscle might be a muscle you've not exercised for a while. But what I really want to encourage people is my lovely mum, who died a year ago, was a great woman for singing along to songs that she did not know the words to. Right? Do you know those people? Yeah. Like the music comes on, they'll go, that's what makes you beautiful. She just couldn't do it. But she knew the tune. And I think sometimes we worry so much about getting every single lyric right that we neglect to enjoy the music. Mm-hmm. You know, faith is not the Macarena. You don't need to do all the same steps at all the same time. Faith is much more of an interpretive dance.
And that, of course, is, you know, you do have a bit in the book where you talk about when people say to you, well, if your God, who is gracious and good and all-seeing, exists, why are there wars in the world and
That's
why is there
question.
So much suffering?
I'd be a billionaire if I knew the answer to that, wouldn't I? It's a mystery. I don't know, but I shall be having words when I get there. You know, and I think the other thing within that sort of statement is, you know, even though I would count myself as having a really privileged life, you know, white, Western, able-bodied, all that sort of stuff, actually none of us are immune to human suffering. I don't think we're being taught something through it all. I think sometimes really bad things happen to really lovely people, and I don't know why. Mm. And it makes me really angry.
But what I do know
is that for me, as a person of faith, of the Christian faith, being professionally religious, when I look at something like the figure of Jesus, there is a solidarity in suffering, which I find really helpful. And also, in that figure of Jesus, whether you think he was the Son of God or not, his crying out on the cross of, my God, why have you forsaken me? Basically saying, God, where the hell are you? If that person of Jesus can do that, then how much more can I do that? And so for me, my faith talks about a solidarity in suffering, which I find really helpful. Because, you know, despite all the show busy stuff, I am still a jobbing vicar. You know, I still bury little coffins for a living, you know, every now and again. And on days like that, when you stood next to a mum who's had to say goodbye to her baby, I don't know where God is. Mm. But I have to just trust that there's a path through that. Mm. What have you got to say in those circumstances except glib words? You know, how do you speak into that? Sometimes you don't. You just hold hands and cry, and that's all you can do.
Yeah, and of course that is, you know, for a person of the clergy, whether it's yourself as a vicar or a priest or an imam or, you know, a rabbi, so much of your job is just about holding hands with people through the difficult times in life, isn't it?
Oh, there were no atheists on the Titanic, let's put it that way. Mm-hmm. And there is a lot of that. And there's a lot of people come in to us as professionally religious people with whatever scrap they've got to offer. Because the other thing that we've done a disservice as, we've done an awful PR job for Jesus as the church. We've said no a lot. And so people have found the doors locked to them, literally sometimes locked to them. And so what happens is when I go to do a funeral with a family that we're not religious, but granny wants a hymn at a funeral, so we better get a nice vicar. So I get rolled out and I go to their houses and they offer me, it's really funny because they offer this scrap of whatever religion they've got. So they go, we're not religious, but I did go to Brownies, you know, or whatever they've got. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And it's an honour. And my job is to stand in that gap and go, do you know what? It's okay. Whatever scrap of spirituality you've got is beautiful and brilliant. And I had a wonderful moment of snobbery is my big kind of, I can't abide snobbery, as you can probably tell from my vowels. A lot of the time, the church confuses holiness for taste. So, you know, it kind of, we had this recently with silent discos in cathedrals. Mm. So there were a whole load of people getting their knickers in a twist because there was a silent disco in a cathedral, right? So there's a DJ, people dancing, having a good time, maybe had a drink or two. The same people were not getting upset when there was ballet in the cathedral. Do you know what I mean? So don't confuse holiness for taste. And I can't remember why I was answering that question. But no, I like that.
That's quite okay. I mean, that, you know, that what you've just said there as well. I mean, one of the things that I found really interesting is that you say in the book, you know, that some vicars, some priests don't like the kind of use the church just for weddings, funerals and baptisms. But you're really happy with that because
really
you're saying if somebody comes just because it's a baptism or a wedding, at least they're coming into the church.
Yeah, and also if they don't come back, it's me that's not done my job properly. I'm in sales. I'm not in management. Do you know what I mean? I'm flogging something. I'm selling something. I'm selling it. I mean, it's got a great return. It's eternal life, really. There's you don't get a receipt, though. You don't get a return on that. And especially as a Church of England priest, we exist for the benefit of those who are not yet members. That was a very famous quote by somebody, William Temple, said, we exist for the benefit. We are here to serve the nation. I don't think we'll always be the established church, and I think there'll be some benefits when we're not. I think there'll be some downsides as well. But if we are to call ourselves the Church of England, then we are. You have a parish priest, a Church of England parish priest. If you use them. I remember once knocking on a door when I moved into a parish, going, hello, I'm your parish priest. And they went, you're not my parish priest. Don't go to church. I'm still your priest. Still yours. I will still pray for you. For every man, woman, and child in England, there is somebody who prays for them every single day, whether they believe it or not. And I like that. I think that's good.
And you, yeah.
Whether you believe it or not, there's somebody who every day holds you in their thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a lot in the book about kind of forgiveness and learning to love people and learning to show love to people that actually you think are dreadful and scumbags.
Oh, it's the hardest thing about being a person of faith. Yeah. The hardest thing I think about being a Christian is that contractual obligation to forgive others.
Yeah.
That's the hardest thing.
Let's just change the subject a little bit and go back to how you became the TV vicar and how you became
famous.
Don't
tell Richard Coles that, he'll be after me.
Oh, well, I've done Richard Coles at this this festival.
Me too.
Yeah.
I don't think I'm his type.
No, me neither. but we had a very good discussion. I had a very good discussion with him about death.
Oh, vicar's favourite topic. Yeah. This is what happens when you get us together. When you get any clergy together, we try really hard. We go, all right, all right. How's the family? Yeah, fine. Been busy? Yeah. It's like a taxi driver. Been busy? And then you go, So, any good funerals this week then? We love it. We love death. We love death so much. I love death. It's a brilliant topic.
Well, let's move it on from death to weddings.
All right then, okay.
Because it all started.
Yeah, that's how it started. Your question was, how did it start?
With
so,
a wedding.
I'm not from a religious...
Cooling down.
I'm not from a religious family. I wasn't brought up going to church, which I think puts me in a slightly different position because I often don't understand the culture and the language of church. So, for example, when I went forward for training, I'd only ever been to a charismatic evangelical kind of church, and I didn't know that when someone asks you which college you went to, they're not asking which college you went to. They're asking, like, it's like an old boys' network. They're asking who you know and what network you're part of. I didn't know there was such a thing as morning prayer when I started training to be a vicar. Very naive. And that did you know the number of buttons you have on your cassock and which ones are buttoned say something about which bits of the articles of religion you actually believe in? So I did not know this stuff when I started, right? It's a whole language. Anyway, so I'm the vicar that likes to say yes. So when I do weddings, I'll say to the bride, first of all, they come to me and go, can we get married in church? And I go, yes. And then I try and figure out how we're going to make it happen because there are certain rules about where you live and all that sort of stuff. Gary and Tracy were getting married. They've been engaged for 9 years, so they were very ready. Tracy especially was very ready. He'd been married before, you know, it was great setup. They were very into like drama and musical theatre, lovely couple. To this day, they say it was my idea. I think it was theirs. We did a flash mob, right? So I say, yeah, now pronounce your husband and wife and make it your bride. And the music goes, everybody dance now. They had 8 weeks of choreography and dance training. I styled it out, obviously. And we got 10 million hits on YouTube for that. Not everybody loved it.
Because you actually do get quite a lot of criticism.
Oh,
don't
gosh,
you?
I'm a woman. Of course I do.
For your vacuous TV and.
Oh,
and
completely superficial. Yeah. Shallow as a puddle. It's fine. When it first hit, I remember when the flash mob first hit. And of course, at that point, I was a jobbing parish priest. So all my details were public, my phone number, where I lived, all that stuff. And the phone started ringing. And I'm really naive because I like most people. And I presume that most people like other people. Yeah, I'm a bit of a Labrador. I'm a bit of a spaniel, really. And so I'm like, people are going to love this, right? This is great, right? This is a wedding. People are going to be really happy about this. Jesus' first miracle was water into wine at a wedding. So he likes a party as well. So everyone's going to like this, right? Not everybody liked it. And people literally phoning me up and shouting at me down the phone. And every time, like, something like, I was just saying outside, every time something like, would I lie to you, is repeated, I get a whole new wave of people that hate me and tell me I'm going to burn in
hell. How do you cope with that, Kate? I mean, because, you know, you're very honest in the book about the things that you do find difficult. About
I type the reply that I want to type, and then I delete it.
And you delete it. But it must be really, even with all your faith, it must be really hard to withstand that and not let it bring you down and not let it change who you
are.
Yeah,
it does change you. It has to change you, you know. It has to change you because you have to be careful with yourself. Mm. You have to protect yourself. And some of the stuff is more than just, I can't stand you on Songs of Praise. It's more than that. You know, people will send in death and rape threats and things like that, you know. And you have to take them to police and all sorts. Yeah. People, but it is more about the person that's doing it than it is. Although I did once send the coppers round to someone's house, which was a lot of fun. Can I tell you about that? So this particular gentleman was sending me pictures of his body parts, which I can only presume look bigger from above.
I just don't get that at all.
Why do that? They're not pretty things either.
Why?
Do you know what I mean? And what does he think it's going to achieve? That I'm going to go, oh, that's nice. Here's 26 years of marriage.
Yeah.
I'm going in this direction for a random stranger off
Absolutely.
The internet. No idea. I only presume, as I say, it looks bigger from above. So he sent me all these pictures and I was like, this has just got to stop now because, you know, and I went to the police and I thought I was being a bit silly. I thought it was just something that comes with the territory because basically every woman you ever see on TV has had this, right? It is not an unusual thing. Every woman you have ever seen on television gets threats and pictures of things that they don't want to see sent to them. It is a very normal, it's not normal, very normal thing. Mm-hmm. So I went to the police thinking I was just being a bit silly, and the police said, oh, no, 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 this is a gateway. If we don't stop these people now, who knows where this goes? So I kind of put over the materials and my copper phoned me up because it's a small place where I live, so I drink in pub with most police officers. But he phoned me up and said, do you want to come into the station and we'll update you on your case? And I went in and I went, so what's happened? And he went, well, officially I need to tell you that we've been to visit the gentleman in question and he won't be bothering you again. I said, oh, that's lovely. That's lovely. Thank you very much. And unofficially, we knocked on his door, Kate, and he shit himself. Pardon my French. But that's what that police officer said. And I went, that's all I wanted. Apparently his girlfriend, Nancy, knows she wasn't very pleased either. He won't be doing it again to anyone else.
I'm not sure.
God bless him.
Yeah, I'm not sure where to go with that one. So, Gogglebox producers spot you. They send you.
Yep.
They contact you. You end up on Gogglebox, and as they say, the rest from there is history.
I mean,
I think it's not just that you did a dance as a vicar or whatever. I think it is the fact that you appear quite unvicar-like.
That's a funny thing, isn't it? Because I think the cultural memory... I always wonder where this comes from, because I don't know if you know many vicars, but all the vicars I know, pretty much, that I hang out with, are like normal people. Yeah. And also a bit on the edge of sanity, like normal people. You know, we believe in a man raised from the dead. It's not normal, is it? So all the vicars I hang out with are all like to go out dancing or have a normal life or shout at their kids or, so I don't know who these vicars are that when people go, oh, you're not like a normal vicar. I can only presume that cultural memory is very long and what we're thinking about is male, pale and stale.
Yeah.
What we're thinking about is Dad's Army vicars. You know, that's the vicar on Dad's Army is what we're thinking about. So I can only presume that that's what it is. Which, again, we've done such a disservice, really. And when people... And this happens to all my vicar mates. They go, oh, you're the nicest vicar we've ever met. If more vicars were like you, more people would come to church. And I just go, well, my church is half empty on a Sunday, so that quite clearly that's not the case, right? So, I don't know who these evil vicars are that are lurking in the shadows. But I think also what happens is we've all had a no at some point. We've all had somebody who wouldn't christen a baby or wouldn't marry somebody or was a bit grump or forgot a name at a funeral. And that sort of stuff stays in the memory, I think.
Yeah, and kind of, as you say, thinking back to that and thinking back to the past. I mean, let's just stay on that subject of modernisation, because you yourself earlier, you don't talk about this in the book, but you touched there on the question of what is the future of the Church of England and disestablishment, disestablishmentarianism, that's the longest word, isn't it, in the English language, but, the Church of England disestablishing from the state as well. And I think that is quite interesting, because I don't know much about the discussions that are going on in the church, but obviously there's lots of questions that anyone in religion is having to think about. I mean, I know more about what's going on in the Catholic Church because my mother just talks to me endlessly about the latest article she's read in the Tablet about, Vatican III and
she
where
she prays for you every day.
Oh, and where the Pope's going with
she
Vatican III.
She says a rosary for you every day.
And she'll sit there and, my mum regularly once a month goes to an LGBT plus mass and she says, she hopes that some point and she's desperate for priests to be able to get married and all those kind of things, So it's the Church of England also going through that very similar thing of really thinking about equality, justice, responding to the modern world in which we live.
We're asking some big questions and the church moves really slowly, which is really frustrating for lots of us. And the big debate in the church, wherever you sit in this conversation, is do we split and go, okay, these are the people that are inclusive of our LGBTQ plus siblings, and these are the people that aren't, and we'll just go our separate ways? Or do we try and keep what was called the communion together at all costs? At the moment, it's try and keep the communion together. It's a bit like having someone at Christmas dinner who's a relative who you don't really get on with, but you've got to invite them to Christmas dinner because you're trying to keep family together. It feels a bit like that. At what point do you start saying, look, I'm not inviting them anymore? I'm not sitting down at the table with them anymore. And that's the debate around this. Now, it's really easy for me to say because I'm not paid by the Church of England. I'm non-stipendary. All my church stuff's voluntary. My job is writing and telly and radio and all that kind of thing. So it's really easy. No one can sack me So it's really easy for me to say, I'll do same-sex weddings. But for other people, it's not so easy in parish. No. You know, and people are leaving churches and taking away their, I mean, taking away their finances. Big debate at the moment is there's some conservative churches that are saying that they're going to split, but they're still going to live in the vicarages and take the stipend and the pension.
And of course, that's difficult all that because sort of people stuff. Have got their homes linked.
Yeah,
linked
and we,
to
but we've also got a global,
and,
we've yeah, also yeah. got a global communion to think about. Yeah. So we've got things like the Southern Cone churches, the African churches, the Episcopal Church in the United States, and we're trying to keep. It's not just this communion in this country, it's a global Anglican communion that we're going, well, how do we find a way through this?
And I think that is interesting, you know, that, and that whole thing about if your house is linked to your job and stuff, it's not as easy with that. My mother-in-law actually was a Church of England vicar, and unfortunately she died a few years ago, but not that long before she died, she left and she became a Quaker.
Yeah.
And she would...
I do that, but I'm not she was
still,
staying quiet.
No, you're not saying. But she would still be doing some services, but then she was going and joining the Quaker services. And when I was talking to her about it, you know, I was saying, why is this? And she said a lot of it was down to different interpretations that people have got of the Bible and her being told that she would have to have a certain one. There's another quote you've got in your book, which I think is a really kind of quite radical statement that you make about that whole question of how much of the Bible do you take literally or not. And you said, I take the Bible far too seriously to take it literally. Yeah. So much of faith for you is about your interpretation, isn't
it? Well, for me, as a solid Anglican, it's a three-legged stool. So the way that we figure out our faith is through the Bible, through experience, and through tradition. Those are the three things that I try and figure it out. You know, I wouldn't be eating prawns and wearing mixed fibres if I took it all literally, would I? You know, so it is a document up for interpretation. I wouldn't be ordained if we took it literally. You know, it's not like that for me. And increasingly, the issue around LGBTQ plus people, for me, is...
Because you really care about
it's a human rights issue. Yeah. It's gone beyond theology and churchmanship now. It's basic human rights. We used to justify slavery using the Bible. And I think we will be judged by subsequent generations who will look back on this and go, this is, you know... Mm-hmm. And it's difficult. It's a really difficult subject. As I say, I'm fortunate because I'm out of it. I'm not risking a career on it. But there are people who are having to risk their livelihoods.
Let's just sort of move that debate on just a little bit as well. Because for me, one of the things I find fascinating about, you know, spirituality, faith, religion is the difference and whether those things, sometimes people confuse those things and think they're the same thing, and of course they're not. I had this wonderful, wonderful friend, Diane, and unfortunately she died quite early on in the start of COVID. And she was, I don't know if anyone was around, Diane Saunders, you might know her name. She was a really big activist in the Leeds Jewish community, and she wrote a lot of books about it. She did a lot of history about Leeds Jewish community. And she used to regularly say, she used to go, oh, she said, I just love being Jewish, right? I love every minute of it. Don't believe in God, but I love being Jewish. And I think that sometimes people confuse faith, don't they, with religion culture.
I think there's lots of overlapping things. I think when I talk about faith and belief, what I'm talking about, I talk about this in the book, is that there's something about connecting with other human beings, like we're doing right now, having a lovely chat. We may never meet again, but we're having a lovely time connecting with each other right now. And you've all had moments like that where you connect with another human being and it's a beautiful thing. Then there's this quest to connect with ourselves, to know ourselves as well as we can, to develop as a human being. And then I think there's something called connecting with something other. Now, I call that other God. Other people might call it, my daughter's friends talk about the universe a lot. So they go, I can't pray, but I'm going to manifest it in the universe.
Me and the universe and I'm are really thinking, good mates. Yeah, I'm with your daughter on
sounds
this.
Sounds awfully like prayer to me. Right? And I remember when mindfulness first, you know, that whole conversation around mindfulness, I phoned up a nun friend of mine. And I went, oh, I'm thinking about running a mindfulness course. What do you do mindfulness? And she went, darling, we've been doing it for 2,000 years, love. It's called meditation. Do you know what I mean? It's just a new overcoat on an old... So when my daughter's friends talk about manifesting in the universe, you know, I hear something else in that conversation. What I hear is that people don't like to use the word God because they think of an old man on a cloud with a beard that controls the weather and judges them.
But I also think some of it may well be to do with those rituals of religion, that people look at some of those. I say people, probably me, but...
Is this your therapy? Do I need to turn my chair?
No, it is, isn't it?
A minute.
It is,
let me just do the vicar head tilt.
It is actually, isn't it? All this... Too many years
been
schooled in Catholicism. But now I think, you know, from what you've just said there, you know, if people are after something spiritual, something higher, that sometimes the ceremony of religion, some people love it and get it, and you talk about how important it is. And I think for other people, they find that ceremony can be a bit of a barrier.
I think they find those ceremonies, but we build our own ceremonies anyway. People build their own ceremonies. You can take away the formalised ceremonies of the church, which perhaps you feel uncomfortable with, but I bet you've got your own ceremonies. So if I can give you a concrete example of this. My mum died, right? My mum died. Me and my dad have always had that relationship where when I phoned that house, my dad would go, oh, hello, love, I'll just get your mum. That was the relationship, right? I love my dad. My dad loves me. But I went out for coffee with my dad. My dad went to football with my brother. That's how it worked. Working class family, very set roles. My mum dies. What do we do now? So me and my dad are looking at each other going, all right then, what do we do now? I don't think we've ever had a proper conversation about anything other than our kids. Did you see Sheffield United and that pile of rubbish on Saturday? That's the most conversation me and my dad have had. So what are we going to do? So my mum's, being a Yorkshireman, he hasn't interred my mum's ashes yet because he wants to save on a plot and put them both in together. So obviously... Even though I told him I could get a deal for him, because I know people.
Can you get a discount?
Seriously, when she died, I'll come back to that story in a minute, but when she died, I said to my dad, because obviously what I wanted was just to sit back and be the daughter. So I said to my dad, look, let's just get the undertaker. They're called undertakers because they undertake everything for you. Let's just get the funeral director to do everything, Dad. The flowers, the order of service, the whole thing. Let's just get them to do it, and then we can just... Oh, no, Katie. I think we can probably call in a few favours, don't you?
So I'm 10%. Did you want his 10% staff discount?
So I am stood in the going. How much can you do me on flowers? Yeah. How much can you do me on a car? How much can I get a deal on a coffin for my mother? And I'm like, this is just not right. Anyway, he got the price that he wanted, so he was happy. But we've not interred the ashes. So where do I go for my ritual? Where do I go for my ritual? Because I've not got somewhere to go and put my flowers and stand there and have a thought. So I was like, but I've got to have somewhere to do this. I've got to have somewhere to do this. So my dad, one week I turned up and he'd got a framed picture of my mum that he'd put on the hearth, he'd put on the fireplace. And then next week I turned up and he put a candle in front of the picture. Aww. And he started lighting the candle every night. Right? And then my mum's favourite flowers were yellow roses. Thank goodness they weren't like something expensive. Thank goodness you can get them for £3 from Co-op. Brilliant, right? So now I start buying, every time I go and see my dad goes, oh, I ain't had flowers in house since your mum died. So I turn up with flowers. My dad goes, what you bought me flowers for? I don't want flowers. I go, they're not for you, they're for my mother. So I go and get a vase out. I put the flowers in the vase. We put the flowers in front of the candle and the picture. We stand and hold hands. My dad goes, look what your daughter's brought you, Margaret. I go, there you are, Mum, there's some flowers for you. We stand and hold hands. We light the candle. We look at the flowers. We look at the thing. And then he goes, right, I'll put kettle on. And we've built a ritual because human beings love ritual. We love it because when we've not got the words and the language, when we've not got the capacity to feel those big feelings, the ritual carries us through. So even if you're not into the rituals of the church, which I find really helpful, you know, coming back to that, what I was saying earlier, when I do a tragic, all funerals are tragic, but when I do a really bad one and I have got no words to say, it's okay because the ritual will carry me. Those words are there for me and they're there for a reason. The ashes to ashes, dust to dust words are there for a reason because they carry us when we've not got that language. So even when people go, oh no, I don't, the rituals of the church put me off. I think you've probably got rituals of your own that you just haven't, whether that's lighting incense, whether that's your yoga or your Pilates or whatever, your desire to connect with something bigger than yourself is inherent in every human being.
And you talk a lot about our need to belong and to be part of something bigger. And I really like the bit where you're talking about Glastonbury as well. And obviously everybody's just
best
been
weekend of my life. Better than my wedding.
Watching Glastonbury on telly.
Graham had set same.
But you kind of talk about, you know, festivals becoming such an important part of people's lives because they belong, they go to something, they found the tribe.
You look around at anything, whether it's the bowls club or cold water swimming or festivals, we are searching for connection and meaning and those golden moments when we acknowledge that there is something bigger than us in the universe. The Celtic Christians used to talk about thin places. Wish I was in a thin place, but that's a different story. So they would talk about thin places where heaven and earth are very close to each other. And you will know these moments in your own existence, whether you are religious or not, when babies are born, when people die, when you have that sense of, oh, flipping heck, I am very small in this big universe. Or isn't it amazing that I'm alive right now? Or that wonderful moment of connectedness. So it happened to me, Glastonbury tour. I was doing Songs of Praise from Glastonbury, which was the most fun I've had with Macassar Coffin in ages, I'll tell you. Glastonbury tour, it was a solstice, it was sunrise. So you can imagine the spiritualities at the top of Glastonbury tour on solstice day, can't you? There was the pagans over here and the witches over there and the Christians over here and the, I don't know what they were doing, but they were having a lovely time and none of them had got any clothes on. They were having a nice time. There was some drumming going on over here. There was some bikers, quite a lot of drugs. Some barefoot children with beads in their hair, you know, all sorts of things. It was marvellous. And I'd climbed the tour because it's supposed to be where Joseph of Arimathea, came back and he planted the bush and all this sort of stuff. And it's got all sorts of connections and all that kind of thing. So I thought it's a place of pilgrimage. I'll take my shoes off. And also, you're not going to be the weirdest person there, are you? No one's staring at me. I've got a dog collar and no shoes and socks. I'm really normal in that place. So I take my shoes and socks off and I walk up the tour barefoot and then I do the last bit on my hands and knees because it's a pilgrimage, right? So I get to the top of the tour and the sun's about to come up and I sit next to this gentleman in leathers. He'd got leathers on. And I sit down and I'm sat there and actually I'd not got my dog collar on at that point. And I look over and I go, hello. And he goes, hello. And he's got a spliff the size of a small carrot. It's like massive, huge thing. He's got a spliff and a bottle of Jack Daniels, right? He's having a lovely time. Who am I? He's finding his connection that way. Fair play. He's a grown-up. It's entirely up to him, right? So I'm sat there and the sun's coming. And he turns around and he goes, I know you. And I go, do you? He goes, I know you. And I'm thinking, here it comes. Gogglebox, that's what's coming, because that's the thing white van drivers shout at me in hen nights. So I'm presuming that he might be in that camp. So he goes, Songs of Praise. Well, you could have knocked me down. He didn't look like our usual audience. I didn't, you know, if I tell you that I could go to the coolest nightclub in the world and nobody would recognise me, I go to a garden centre, I get mobbed. That's how this works, right? So I go, really? Like that? And he goes, Songs of Praise, Songs of Praise. And I said, tell me about that then, because I'm really interested now. I'm really interested now. What's he doing watching Songs of Praise? Judging me here. I think my gaffer said something about not judging people, but here we go. So he says, yeah, my mum's got dementia. She's in a nursing home. And every Sunday we put Songs of Praise on. And she doesn't speak, she's nonverbal. But when we put Songs of Praise on and there's a hymn she knows and the words come along the bottom, we sit and we sing together and we hold hands. And just for half an hour, I've got my mum back. And we sit and sing those old hymns together. So thank you so much for Songs of Praise. And I went, you're so welcome. And then he said, would you mind if we sang now? And I went, no, let's sing. So we watched the sun come up over the tour on solstice day and we sang Morning Has Broken together, just me and him. And we had the most beautiful moment of connection with each other, connection with ourselves and connection with the concept of something higher than us. I weren't going to ruin it by going, would you like to give your life to Jesus? You know, I wasn't, it wasn't, he was as much on that spiritual path as I was. He might not have the language that I use, but he has as much right to access the stuff of faith and spirituality as anybody. He then did go, do you want some of this? And I went, I think I'm all right, pal, but I will have a little sniff of Jack Daniels with you. So, yeah, we had a communion. Mm. And that's what I mean when I'm talking about connection and faith and spirituality. Please don't let church put you off God.
Well, before we go to some questions, just one other thing to I just wanted to say. Actually, I feel quite teary. I mean, despite the fact I knew that story because I'd read it in the book, because I feel quite teary and emotional.
It's a good one. It was a golden moment. It was very good. It was one of those moments where, and this happens to me all the time. You know, I can spend hours and hours in church, hours and hours praying, hours and hours. I don't spend hours. That was a lie. That was a barefaced lie. I'm so sorry. I just lied. I'm so sorry. I can spend hours and hours, you know, doing the religious stuff. But actually, for me, the moments when God speaks to me most is through things like that, is through encounter, is through watching telly, listening to a song, you know. And that's what's so brilliant is, you know, when we say, don't let church or religion put you off God, that's what we're talking about, is we don't own this stuff. Those of us who are professionally religious do not own, we do not have a monopoly on faith and belief. Grace is not a finite resource. If I hand it out, there's not going to be enough to go around. It is for, and that's what the book's all about. The book is all about just going, look, we don't own this stuff. And for too long, those of us who are religious, and I'm signed up at office. You know, I've paid at head office, me. Those of us who are professionally religious, sometimes in our arrogance, have a monopoly on belief. And I think that's nonsense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that's a great place to go to some questions, because I think this next bit about the other stuff that's in the book, which is actually just a lot about living a life that's true to ourselves and understanding ourselves and knowing ourselves and thinking about life not in material terms,
yeah,
but
and
in,
also
in development terms.
That
there's a lot of that in
us,
the book.
That there's a, you know, the hardest funerals idea, I always say this, you know, people think the hardest funeral you must do must be those tragic ones. They're not. The hardest ones you do are the ones where you've got nothing to say. A crematorium on a Wednesday afternoon. You know, and you're thinking, I'm a fill in 20 minutes. Mm. Those are the hardest ones to do, you know, because, I mean, and that's fine. If you don't want to fill your days with lots of stuff, that's fine. By the way, horses with plumes, people in the street, item on the news. That's what I'm having. That's what I want. I don't want any of this celebration of life nonsense. I want weeping in the streets. All right? I want absolute, you know, rending of garments, a pale Victorian child, that kind of stuff. I think I tell this story in the book. Horses with plumes. I once had a brilliant funeral where they had a horses with plumes funeral. I love them. And I always take an apple in my pocket or polo mints for horses. Obviously, of course I do. So I'm feeding horses outside, and funeral director's supposed to be riding up top with groom. Anyway, funeral director's scared of horses. He's not getting up there. So he goes, Bartley, do you want to get up? Yeah, of course I do. So I'm clambering up this like that with my bum up like that. Clamber up onto the top of us, and we're going from church down to cemetery to bury this lovely lady who, lovely family, great family, down to salt to earth. And I'm sat on the top of the carriage, and we're trotting along like that, right that. And I'm having a lovely time. And and the groom went, rein it in, Botley. And I went, why? She went, you're not a bloody Disney princess. It's like, oops, sorry, vicar face.
Do we have a microphone? Yeah, brilliant, we've got a microphone. It's great if anyone's asking a question, can use the mic, because then everybody can hear you.
Oh, look, aren't you beautiful?
Yeah. So who would like to ask a question or say something or just say something to Kate?
You talked a little bit there about the thin place, and I really like that. My little thin place is I have a caravan in the Dales and I go and sit by the edge of a stream. What would be your thin place?
Great question. So I recently, about 6 years ago, got really, I know everybody's doing it, I'm so sorry. Cold water swimming is one of my places. So being in the water, I really enjoy. Coldest swim I've done is about -2. And you really know you're alive when you do that. You only know you're alive because you know you're not dead, right? And it just keeps it ticking over. So that's a big place for me. Dancing, lots of spiritual experiences in the middle of gigs and nightclubs and all sorts of places like that. So those are really important places. But also, I don't think the thin place thing necessarily needs to be a geographical place. It can be like a time sort of place. And most of those, I have to say, are in rooms where people are leaving the world. Those are beautiful spaces to be in. If you've had that privilege of being with someone when they're coming to the end of their lives, it can be a truly amazing experience. Tragic, painful, difficult. I mean, I don't know if you've read the book by Catherine Mannix called With the End in Mind, which talks you through the dying and death process. And actually, for the person in the bed, they're apart from all the sort of legal drugs that they're being pumped with, also your body realises it's dying, so it throws everything at it. Mm. So it throws all your endorphins and all your dopamine and all your lovely things. The irony of it is, in your last few moments, you'll probably feel the best you've ever felt. And, you know, being in those spaces, I think as well, because I'm not scared of that sort of stuff, it's a bit like being in the room when someone's like giving birth, and I've done that a few times as well, two of my own and a few other people's as well. It's a real honour and a privilege to be in those spaces, those transitionary moments. So, thin places, water, dancing, and death.
Hello, Kate.
Hello. If someone next could ask a question on the front row, that would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Just so I can just do that. You watch your footing, you. Where there's blame, there's a claim. Go on.
As an atheist yet to face their Titanic, I love the stories of the Bible. That's where I come at them. Mystery plays, passion plays. You made a fantastic documentary about Judas.
Yeah, I loved that documentary.
I loved it too.
Team Judas.
Team Judas. Love I'm him. Team Judas, which is all about forgiveness and, of course, core of that faith. Without, I don't want to give any spoilers, but how do I forgive you for your choice? Because I didn't understand it.
For my choice of...
Of not forgiving Judas.
For me, not forgiving Judas. Well, that was a long time ago. And the brilliant thing about faith and belief is it changes. So that was 7 years ago, that documentary. I'm not sure... Well, I think what I said in the last quote is I'm not sure I'm ready to forgive him just yet, was what I think what I was sure of. I think that's the other thing that's really important to say about faith is it is not the same thing. My faith wasn't the same this morning when I woke up as when I go back to bed tonight. And I think one of the things we really need to normalise in society is people changing their mind about stuff. That you might think this now, but you might not think that tomorrow. So I think what I said in the documentary was, I'm not ready to forgive him just yet. I think I probably am now.
I was going to say,
have you moved on? I think so. Someone had to do it, right? And I think we all like to think we'd be a Mary Magdalene at the foot of the cross looking lovingly. But I think we all probably know that that's not what we'd be.
It was fabulous.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. It was a really good...
Is it still on iPlayer or
no,
somewhere?
It was a long time ago. It was one of the first things I did. I left Gogglebox to do... So Gogglebox have exclusivity and you're not allowed to do any other telly. So you can't be watching the telly and commentating it if you're then on the telly. It kind of breaks the sort of vibe. So I left Gogglebox to do that documentary. And it was an amazing thing. And there's a church, I think it might be Sussex, I can't remember. You have to Google it. Where there's a stained glass window which has got Judas in it taking his own life, which is the tradition of what happened to Judas after he betrayed Jesus. And it was put in, it was so controversial, this window of Judas hanging himself, that it took 7 years for it to be installed before the PCC could agree on it. So it's an amazing thing. Yeah, I think we'd all like to think we'd be Mary Magdalene. I think we all think. I think we know where most of us would be, right? When the chips are down and there's a knife at your throat.
Thank you. What a fantastic question we've got.
See, I told you,
question there, and then we're one going over halfway. Here after as well.
First of all, I'd like to celebrate. It's been 10 years and I've never asked a question.
I love this.
Yes.
I'm empowered to do this. Yes.
Thank you very much. Okay, here I go.
Woohoo!
True or false?
Oh, God.
Yes, darling. In my journey, I have found that I've had to unlearn some things I thought I knew. And in my I am a Christian and I'm unashamedly a Christian. All right, love. Have you found that you've had to unlearn the things you thought you were faithful at in order to be faithful?
Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Explain why.
Yeah, so I came to faith at 14 and I came to faith in a very evangelical, charismatic context. And I can pinpoint the exact moment I went from not believing in God to believing in God. It was literally a moment. And I came to faith in a Christian union at school, and I went to things like New Wine and Spring Harvest, and that was my spirituality. And I never questioned it. It was, you know, and I remember being told as a 14-year-old that if my mum and dad and my brother weren't saved, they were going to burn in hell, and it would probably be my fault that they weren't saved. Now, I don't know where your spirituality is. I don't know what your Christian, for those of you that are of the Christian faith, where you are on that. But I think that's probably abusive to tell a 14-year-old that their family are going to burn in hell if they don't do something about it. I see that as abusive now. I'm like, Who tells a 14-year-old that their mum's going to burn in hell? That's a ridiculous thing to say. Or they would soften it by saying they're not going to heaven. That's what they would say. So I unlearned a lot of that kind of inherited theology that I needed to deconstruct in order. And lots of people deconstruct the religion that they have when they're a child and then never reconstruct it. So they just deconstruct it. They go, right, I don't believe any of this anymore. Therefore, I don't believe any of this anymore. But what I did was sort of go, well, I definitely don't believe some of this stuff anymore. So what do I believe? And then rebuilt it, reconstructed it. I fully expect I'm going to have to do that again at some point. You know, I've not arrived at a destination. Mm. You know, and I said this to baptism families that bring their babies for christening, and you can see the godparents sort of shuffling one foot to the other because they're about to be asked what they believe and they don't really know and they're not really sure. And I just go to the pub with him and we knew each other at school and I'm not really sure what I'm doing here. You know, for those of you that have ever been to baptism christenings, there's a lot of shuffling from one foot to another and they go, I'm not really religious. And I go, it's okay, I'm religious enough for everybody. You know, you just need to be prepared to ask the questions and have the conversation and be prepared to go, I just don't know, but let's figure it out together. And you might never get the answers, really. But yeah, I'm always very concerned when anybody says to me, well, the Bible clearly says, because it very clearly says not very much. It's very contradictory. Or, well, the Christian faith clearly says, does it? Does it? Because I'm not sure it does. And I think that it's perfectly possible to be full of doubt and full of questioning and still be a person of faith. I think the Bible's really clear about loving people and not judging. I think it's probably really clear about that. But lots of other stuff, it seems to me. Love the Lord your God and love your neighbour as yourself is pretty clear, I would argue. But beyond that.
I mean, there's a phrase you use in the book, and now tell me if I don't want to be putting words in your mouth, but the way I read it, I got the impression that this is the one constant for you, that whatever else around your faith might be changing or you're thinking each day, I'm not sure what I believe. But it feels, reading the book, your constant is, and I'm quoting from the book, the fact that I am loved by the author of life itself is the foundation of my faith.
So what blows my tiny mind when I'm having one of, is that the author, inventor of love in the universe, which I call God, loves me. The being, the entity, the energy, the whatever, that first brought love into being, loves me. That's incredible. That's amazing. And loves you. And I'm a rat bag. And there is nothing I can do to add or to diminish from that love.
I think that must be the most wonderful comfort in life, to go through life knowing that, because you're never alone, are you?
It's so empowering. It's the most empowering thing, I think, that no matter how much I mess up or I'll get it right or any of it, there is nothing I can do to add to or subtract to that love. You know, it is an incredible feeling to be held as beloved. And when you were asking earlier, how do you cope with people that are mean and horrible to you? Well, that's... But the challenge of it is, you know, when they're mean and horrible, I think, well, I'm loved, so it's all right, isn't it? But the challenge is that so are they. That's the challenge, isn't it? So are they. I believe so are they.
That's the learning to love
Who... Even the worst person that ever existed. Yeah. And that's the really hard thing about being a Christian. Mm. That's the really hard thing, is that I can't subtract. Okay.
What a great question, though. Thank you. So we had one here, and then we've got one down here. We had one in the middle here.
You know, you can ask anything.
But let's go down.
You know,
to
it don't need to be theology. You know, you can ask about sewing bee and MasterChef and all that sort of stuff.
I was just going to go back to what the gentleman said about Judas.
Oh yeah.
Now, would you think that was part of God's plan? And do you believe that God has got a plan for us all?
That's such an interesting phrase, isn't it? Because sometimes people talk about, oh, well, it's all part of God's plan. It's really hard to think that when you're sat with a mummy whose baby's died. I can't look that person in the eyes and say that. So, no, I don't think there is a plan that is all written out. Every single dot of a full stop, cross of a T is all arranged. I think it's a bit like freeform jazz. Go with me. I'm going to explain. So, you know, like that really cool jazz music that we all pretend to like, but we don't really understand sometimes. Lovely jazz. I mean, maybe you do understand it. I don't. So when jazz music, as I understand it, I'm married to a musician, I'm not a musician, but as I understand it in my non-musician brain, When you get people together that do freeform jazz, right? So a clarinet and a piano and a singer and a big double bass thing and whatever, they don't know where they're going, right? They don't know what the tune... They don't go, oh, we're going to play this song and then we're going to play this song and this is the set list. They don't do that. They sort of... Someone starts playing and then someone joins in and then it kind of goes in a direction. There's sort of a rough outline, but you kind of never know where it's going to end up. So there's sort of a plan, but not a plan. And it's up to... And it can kind of go in all sorts of directions. But they know they're going to play a piece of music for 10 minutes and then they're going to go to the bar and get a drink, whatever. So it has a plan, but it doesn't have a plan. And I think it might be a bit like that. Does that make sense?
So you believe that God has got his hand on you anyway?
I believe, yeah. I believe this. So the one I can think of, and also I acknowledge that we don't have, we're trying to understand an entity that is completely unique in the universe that we have nothing else to compare it to. How can we understand it? As brains are really, really tiny compared to... So we're thinking about a supreme entity in the universe that is incomparable and incomprehensible and ultimate, and there's nothing else like it. So it's a bit like, I think I said this in the book, I get asked on I'm a Celebrity every year, right? I'm not doing it. It's not happening, all right? I'm not that skint yet, all right? I can't think of anything worse. It's not the snakes and the spiders. It's not the eating challenges. It's not any of that. It's being locked in a jungle with strangers and being forced to get on with them that terrifies me. But when you're on I'm a Celebrity and they're doing those awful Bush Tucker trials where they're eating kangaroos' balls,
yeah.
If you don't watch I'm a Celebrity, this is going to be a really weird comparison. I'm really sorry. I love telly. So what they do is they feed them like kangaroos' testicles. And when they're feeding them kangaroos' testicles and they're having to chew on it or whatever, and Ant and Dec go, oh, does it taste? Like that. I can't do a Geordie accent, right? Ant or Dec says, how does it taste? And the contestant goes, it tastes like chicken. It doesn't taste like chicken. Guess what? Kangaroos' testicles taste like kangaroos' testicles.
How do you know?
But that's the point, right? That's the point I'm making, right? So when we talk about God, we don't know what God's like. So we have to use terms like he and father and shepherd. And of course, God is none of those things, but all of those things. Because when we taste kangaroo testicles, we have to say it tastes like chicken. It doesn't taste like chicken. It tastes like kangaroo's testicles. But we have to compare it to something that we do know. Because we're describing something that we don't. You get what I'm saying? So all language is inadequate when we're talking about God. All theology is inadequate when we're talking about God. Who knows? We don't. That's the whole point.
We've got time for one last question.
That was like proper theology then.
That was.
Is everybody all right? Do we need to stretch out? Let's just... Goodness me.
You did say to me earlier,
proper theology, that.
What are we talking about? We're telling jokes and gags. And I went, oh, no, I want to have a proper discussion about theology and faith.
Oh, my word.
No, I want to talk about show business.
Who's the nicest person you've ever met and who's an horrible person? Are we doing that one?
Steph's Packed Lunch,
oh,
really.
I loved Steph's Packed Lunch. You did some Steph's Packed Lunch,
yeah,
didn't you?
We loved it, too.
You
must have some stories about that.
Steph's Packed Lunch was the best television programme. It's so naughty. There was a whole lot of naughtiness. I actually found a Tory I liked, which was fun. That was a new experience for me.
I presume you're talking Saida there.
Present company accepted, if anybody's in the house. Yes, Saida Barsay. Love it. I don't think she's a proper one. It's more Lib Dem, really, than anything. So, it was great. It was huge fun. We were endlessly naughty on that show. Lots of being silly.
To be honest, I mean, it did get quite near the edge.
It did get really naughty.
That's what I really liked. Lunchtime.
That's what I really liked about it. You used to get a little voice in your ear going, rein it in, rein it in, like that. Because you were just doing too many double entendres. Yeah. And what I really loved about that show, like I loved Gogglebox, was it was people of all different faiths and none. All different voices and representations, and that's...
They showed on Pat Lunch that you can do diversity.
Yeah, and you can disagree well.
Without it actually even being that obvious as well.
And that's the goal as well.
It can just be, and that's how it is.
And that's the goal, isn't it? Is we don't have to all agree. You don't... I mean, you might walk away from here thinking I'm a dreadful human being, and that's fine. I mean, you're wrong. I'm great. Jesus says so. Guess what? He says it about you as well. It can learn to disagree well is kind of the thing, I think, really.
One last question behind as well. Yeah,
that alarm's gone.
Dead serious.
You're nice.
Dead
serious.
Yeah, I am. I'm good. You're familiar with Father Ted, the programme?
Of course. Yeah.
In your talk, you mentioned a vicar having a cassock and certain buttons undone.
Please don't ask me what I wear under my cassock. Just
certain buttons undone for things that they didn't believe in.
Yeah.
So how many buttons do you think Father Ted and Father Doyle would have undone?
Father Jack got? The money was just resting in my account. I think the brilliant thing about representations of people of faith on TV, Dibley did us loads of favours. Dibley did Women Vickers loads of favours. People already think we're nice and that we like chocolate, so we're on a front foot. I think what is brilliant about representations of clergy, including Ted, including Dibley, including Rev, if you ever saw the series
Rev.
Yeah,
fantastic, Rev.
Fantastic series. One of the most realistic portrayals of vicars on TV, by the way. The number of times on a Friday we've been having a special cuddle and someone's knocked on the door, just saying. Who's that? Tell him to... I can't tell him to piss off, I'm vicar. The wonderful thing about those representations of clergy on TV and why we love them is because it shows them as human beings. It shows them as vulnerable and broken and sweary and irreverent. And we love that idea that those people that we think are the holy, esteemed role models are just like us. That's what we want. And that's all anybody wants, from their postman, their politician, their priest, anybody, is an authenticity, I think. And it's the reason why I won't do the jungle, because I could be the nicest person in the world for 23 hours and 55 minutes. You know the 5 minutes when I'm swearing or telling a dirty story, it's the one that's going to make the edit, because that's what I'd put in. Because we want to see that people are real, don't we?
Yeah. But don't you think Christianity has that ability and establishment to be able to take the knocks and laugh at itself?
Absolutely. And I'm very proud... Very proud of a of being part of a faith, and I think all faiths, like, you know, you should always have a faith that doesn't take itself always too seriously. You know, people, it's always very funny when people blaspheme in front of me, and they go Jesus and Christ,
then they apologize.
So sorry, I've heard a lot worse. You're not my child. It doesn't matter. You know, and. I think, you know, or they apologise for something like The Life of Brian or for Ted or those kind of things. I think that we should always be able to see the ridiculousness of some of what we hold dear. It's, you know, when I'm in a cathedral and we're all flouncing around in frocks and big hats, it's hilarious. And we believe in a man raised from the dead. I know it makes no sense. Yet here I am, because it's called faith. It's not called show. And that's what I said to bishops. When bishops go to me, well, Kate, the thing is, because that's how bishops talk. They go to school to learn that. Not all bishops talk like that now, actually. But it was funny because RP has only just gone out as a thing at vicar schools. They used to have RP. And one parish I know, when they were interviewing a new vicar, their desirable qualities on their job advert said, must not have a regional accent. So they do still exist like that. They're not allowed to get away with it. But sometimes bishops will go to say to me, you do like to be the centre of attention, don't you, Kate? And I go, you wear a big hat and a coat for a living. You've got some need to talk. Don't tell me you're not enjoying it. At least I'm owning my budget. I've monetized it as well. It pays me mortgage.
So, unfortunately, we do have to finish. I know we could carry
we're
on.
4 minutes over.
But the book is called Have a Little Faith.
It is. And it's for the not... it's lovely if you are religious. That's lovely. Thank you. I'll see you when we get there. Save me a seat. And if you're not religious, it's got so much in there.
Yeah.
If you're not religious, I'll see you when you get there. Save me a seat.
Everybody, please give a massive round of applause.
Thank you
to the Reverend Kate Butley.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.